I told you last Sunday at the very end of the sermon, and I remind you of what I told you because I'm under no illusions that you remember those significant statements very long. What I promised was that I would try next Sunday to do a traditional sermon rather than one of those professorial teaching sermons that I rather like to inflict on you from time to time. I meant to do that. But I was tempted beyond my abilities to resist. And so I'm doing what my beloved friend Selma Schmidt, our dear Mennonite Christian sister from Newton, told me this morning she hoped I would do another sermon somewhat like that one last week. So, in honor of the season, let's take a look this morning at how the four different Gospels begin their stories of the life of Christ. Matthew, with a great deal of interest in Jewish hopes, says, "This is the story of the birth of the Messiah." Mark begins with a grown man and says, "Here begins the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Luke, whose introduction is much longer, says, "In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth with a message for a girl engaged to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The girl's name was Mary." And John starts out, "In the beginning was the Word." Before we finish this morning, I hope to show you just how rich and complex that opening chord is in John's Gospel. But on the very simplest level of all, it's a great declaration. In the beginning was the Word. For one thing, it could almost stand as a brief synopsis of human history. Because we are fully human through having the power to say words, hear words, read words, pass along from one generation to another the wisdom we accumulate. But how many Christmas cards will you get or send this year which celebrate the season with that sentence? In the beginning was the Word. I always feel that the opening of John's version of the life of Christ gets cheated during the Christmas holidays. Mark gets left out of Christmas also, but there's not much point in feeling sorry for Mark because for whatever reasons, he simply decided not to bother with a nativity story. His gospel, the first one written of the four we have, starts out with Jesus, already an adult, deciding to walk for 3 days to be baptized. Now you have a right to wonder why Mark would have missed the chance to tell the story of the little miracle child. Did he write so early on that there was no such story yet? After all, the Apostle Paul wrote before any of the Gospels were written, even earlier than Mark, And he never mentions a birth story either. Were such stories not yet current in the church when Paul and Mark wrote? And if not, when and why did they arise? Paul and Mark, if those Christmas stories were already floating around in the oral traditions about Jesus, both ignored them, either because they had some doubts about them or because they were just not interested. It's hard for me to imagine that they would not be interested if they knew those stories and gave them any credence at all, because the birth of the baby Jesus is one of the most cherished traditions in Christian history. But the simple truth is that any of the first century churches that had only Mark's gospel, and there would have been a number of them, would not find the charming story of the Virgin Mary or the Magi or the angel songs or the shepherds who were astonished by them. And if Mark's version of the life of Christ had been the only one we ever got, there wouldn't be a Christmas. We owe that present primarily to Luke, who says, when he begins his gospel, that others have written, but that he wants to do his own version. We also would not celebrate Christmas if we had only the gospel of John, because even though that gospel is thought to have been the last one written, he too, like Mark at the beginning, ignores the whole business about the birth. There is, in the words of my title this morning, no baby Jesus for John. No wise men, no guiding star, no heavenly choir in the night sky over the fields of Bethlehem. You've seen hundreds of Christmas cards with pictures of the baby and the manger, of the Magi in their oriental robes, or those shepherds staring up into the night sky as if it might fall on them at any moment. You get those things on your Christmas cards precisely because they are pictorial, concrete images, stuff you can draw or paint. Now, John has a beginning, one of the most majestic beginnings in any piece of literature in the world, but it is too abstract and philosophical to turn into pictures. It offers no way to set up something tangible in front of a church, no way for people to act it out on Christmas Eve. It's hard to imagine that John, writing so late, had not heard about the birth stories we know, but if so, he had no interest in them. His eyes were looking far beyond the tales of simple shepherds and a crowded inn to a time before time when the Christ he sang about was a partner with God in creation itself. I want you to listen very carefully in a moment to the breathless sweep of John's poetry, thought to have been composed as an early Christian hymn and then picked up and adapted by John to introduce his gospel. Please keep in mind as you hear it that it was not meant to be cold and sober history, but the music of a heart on fire with adoration. Poetry, not science. It is so cosmic in its leap of faith, so mystical in its adoration, that no one has ever felt completely sure about just how to express it in translation. One of the world's greatest students of the Gospel of John is Father Raymond Brown, who with his almost incredible learning wrote two thick volumes on that single gospel for the Anchor Bible series of Translation Plus Commentary. In his translation, the opening of John's gospel is printed in four strophes or stanzas, so it will be more obvious to readers of English that it is truly a hymn. You won't see it that way in most Bibles. We are, after all, still in the process of translating, and Father Brown is a few steps ahead of most commercial publishing houses. Don't be surprised, by the way, that some early Christian hymns sung in church were picked up and included in certain books of the New Testament. It happened more than once. The Roman historian Pliny, writing to one of the emperors, describes some Christians he had seen as singing a hymn to Christ as to a god. One of those hymns may have been what I am about to read. And I'll do it with a rhythm and some pauses to help you know where the lines end, since there is probably not an Anchor Bible translation in the house. Gospel of John, chapter 1, first strophe. In the beginning was the Word was in God's presence, and the Word was God. He was present with God in the beginning. Second strophe. Through Him, all things came into being, and apart from Him, not a thing came to be. That which had come to be in Him was life, and this life was the light of men. The light shines on in the darkness, for the darkness did not overcome it. Third strophe. He was in the world, and the world was made by Him, yet the world did not recognize Him. To His own He came, yet His own people did not accept Him. But all those who did accept Him, He empowered to become God's children. Fourth strophe. And the Word became flesh. That, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is the only bow John makes to the idea of a birth at all. And the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. And we have seen His glory, the glory of an only Son coming from the Father, filled with enduring love. Now, poetry loses something always in translation. But even in English, this bears the mark of self-conscious art, very carefully put together. Now listen with even more care. The brand new Christian story John wants us to notice deliberately echoes the ancient Jewish story. Genesis had started in the beginning, Christianity for John is the new creation, so he too writes, in the beginning. The Jewish creation story has God saying, let there be light. John's Christian creation story picks up the same themes of light and darkness. The echoing is quite deliberate. This is not what we studied in Sunday school, but there's more to the Bible than meets the eye at first glance. Now let's pause to see where we are. Mark begins the very first gospel, so far as we know, ever written, with Jesus grown up. Matthew and Luke move the story of Jesus back to his birth. Matthew and Luke, by the way, were both looking at a copy of Mark when they wrote their Gospels. They added the story of the birth. John's Gospel takes us in the story all the way back to a time before creation itself. Isn't it interesting to watch the evolution of the Jesus story? The oldest gospel starts with a man receiving his call to preach. The next two weave thrilling tales of a miraculous birth. The fourth and last one skips the birth story and says, in effect, this Lord of life, whom we worship, has no beginning or end. As the expression of God himself, he was with God before time and was even a partner in creation. Now that is about as high as the process of adoration can evolve. Now part of the fascination with John's prologue is that he calls Jesus by the Greek term logos, a term never used that way anywhere else in Scripture. So what does it mean? Well, the answer is not easy. We translate logos as word in English, but it carries a complex of ideas. Ideas like thought, wisdom, reason. It's almost as if John is saying, Jesus is the idea of God. Jesus is God spoken. Jesus is the thought and mind of God become visible on earth. So we need to ask another question. Why would it occur to John to write so philosophically when the earliest Gospels had been content to picture Jesus in much more human ways? Or when they did exalt him, to talk about him as the long-awaited Messiah? Well, the answer may be, by John's time, that Christianity had spread widely in the Greek world and had begun to be influenced by Greek ideas. It could be that this majestic introduction to John's gospel represents a way of presenting Jesus that would make sense to the Greeks. It was all right to talk about Jesus as the promised Messiah, just as long as Christianity was mostly a Jewish thing. After all, the Jews had been looking for a Messiah for centuries. All that had to be done was to convince them that Jesus was that Messiah. But the Greeks had no such concept. Reason, mind, ideas, thought, enlightenment, wisdom, Those were the words that excited an intelligent Greek. So, using a word they knew and were excited by, and to which they gave a rich complex of meanings, John says, in effect, you Greeks feel, do you, that wisdom, thought, is God's greatest gift to humanity? Well, let me tell you something. This person, Jesus, whom I write about, was the mind of God Himself walking around on the earth. How could you put that on a Hallmark card? John goes on to say that no one has ever seen God at any time, directly contradicts some of the statements in the Old Testament, but that should not be a surprise to you. No one has ever seen God, he says, at any time, but if we want to know what God is like, look at this Logos, this Jesus, and you will know. One of the great Victorians of the last century said once that it wasn't what his father taught, but the way his father lived that made him believe in the potential for human goodness. Jesus came with no big bundle of original ideas, a fact we talked about in the sermon last week, but he dwelt among us full of grace and truth, John says. He demonstrated a new way of living. People watched. They felt God must be like that. They loved him. And a new religion was born. We have received, John says, grace on top of grace, heaped up, running over, dizzying, amazing grace. It's simply a way of saying that none of the most important things in life are earned. Our birth, our health, the love that makes us human. My friends have come to me unsought, Emerson wrote once. My friends have come to me unsought. The great God gave them to me. Well, John's idea is that Christ heaps upon us more love than we could ever deserve in the hope that we will respond and become better and happier people. If you want people to be great in spirit, Goethe said once, act as if they were, and they rise to greatness. Jesus looks at the unstable disciple named Simon Peter and calls him a rock, and he turns into one. In believing that with him we could create the kingdom of God on earth, Christ staked everything. You can be sons and daughters of God yourselves, he told us. I believe in that possibility. It may well be that in his adoration of Jesus, John got carried away a little bit in his mysticism. But I believe him absolutely when he says that in Jesus there was life and a light the darkness could not overcome, and that by his grace we can stand a great deal taller than we customarily do. And even if he left out the baby and is much too sophisticated for Christmas card art, I'm grateful for the awesome sweep of his own faith and for that matchless prologue to his gospel, "In the beginning was the Word." It is the whole purpose of my ministry to make that Word both real and relevant in my life and yours.